For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time once again for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Over this past weekend, we got tragic news of the passing of Broken Arrow Republican Representative David Brumbaugh. Neva, Representative Brumbaugh was a member of the leadership in the House, not just a beginning freshman.
Absolutely, and such a sad time, such a difficult week for members of the House. Yesterday, his body lay in repose at the Capitol for 4 hours, and of course the funeral will be tomorrow in Broken Arrow, his hometown, where he, in his church, where he was very active as a deacon, Sunday school teacher, and very involved in the community, and someone well-respected among his colleagues, certainly at the Capitol. And it's a tremendous loss, and I think I join with not only his colleagues but constituents and family and friends in saying that our thoughts and prayers are with Representative Brumbaugh's wife and his two daughters.
Ryan, did you get a chance to work with Representative Brumbaugh?
Not real directly, and oftentimes we found ourselves on opposite sides of issues.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that at the end of the day, you know, that doesn't matter. This is a real reminder that the folks at the Capitol, they're all just human beings, mm-hmm. and we've got a finite amount of time here, however you believe, whether you believe this is all you got, this one spin on the rock, or you've got something else after this, this is a real reminder that at the end of the day, this is all we've got here. Mm-hmm. And I think that anytime you have a colleague like that who's passed either in session or during an interim, you know, I can remember legislators that I served with who've passed since they left the legislature, passed while we were in the legislature together, and it's always difficult. I mean, these folks are, even if you are on the opposite side of a trench with them, you become colleagues and you become friends and you get to know them. You see them at events and you get to know their families. And so you have these relationships that are speeded up as a result of the fire that you work in at the Capitol. And to lose somebody like that that you're close to, regardless of political party, is always going to be difficult.
We're just 5 weeks away from the constitutionally required end of the legislative session. On the last day of May, we are now getting word of revenue bills making their way through the process. $28 million worth of measures are heading to the full House floor, and Appropriations Chair Leslie Osborne says more are coming. Ryan, do you think this is going to be enough?
You know, we don't know really know what the blueprint is here. I mean, we're seeing some revenue bills that come out that add, you know, a couple of million here. I think the most adds, you know, around $20 million to the revenue. We're facing nearly a $1 billion shortfall and trying to get our way there by adding a million or 2 million here in revenue. I mean, I applaud those. I mean, those are things that need to happen, but we're missing a bigger part of the conversation here. We're not going to close that $900 million hole by, you know, $2 million at a time. And if you look at some of the things that are happening right now, they're the easy things. They're fee increases. They're making life more expensive for people who are already having a hard time. You know, coin machine vendor operators. I mean, these folks are not rolling in the dough. I mean, they might be making a decent living, but
they'll have to pass that cost along.
And they're passing that cost along. And so, you know, we see these fee increases and these small tax increases. But unless we're talking about gross production tax, unless we're talking about moving that from 2% to the historic rate of 7%, if we're not talking about increasing income tax on the upper income earners in the state of Oklahoma, we're really not going to get close to the $900 million. Just raising the gross production tax back to 7%, the historic rate, would put about $450 million back into the budget. I mean, that gets us halfway there. And that's a big lift even at that.
And Neva.
And I think Ryan is right. I mean, we've got this chipping away right now with measures that were had overwhelming support, but they also only needed 51% to pass.
Right.
So we're now moving toward, both the Appropriations Chair in the House and the Senate have said, I mean, they want to really move swiftly the next 3 weeks to try to get a budget crafted. But I think the devil's in the details, as we've said all along. I mean, is it on the side of what Ryan is outlining, or is it something different? And I think for Republicans, what they've really I think yet to come to terms with and be able to successfully grapple with is the fact that we have a continued increase in state government. I mean, when you look at the budget, FY 15-16, I mean, the increase, there was a $4.1 billion increase, I mean, that we actually saw in spending. And when they start to get into the weeds of that, they can't really determine where a lot of that money is. And so I think they've got to really hone in these agencies who are pushing back. I mean, when you start talking about privatizing areas, immediately those agencies are, you know, on the Capitol steps talking to lawmakers saying, oh, no, that's not a good option. If you start saying selling off assets, then there's pushback on that. If you talk about the state-owned health choice insurance, whether you want to privatize that, which some people have said is $170 or $80 million savings, or privatizing some services perhaps in DHS, largest agency in the state, maybe $100 million. So you start talking $100 million versus $2.8 or $3 million or some of these bills that were passed this week. That's where you start making the seismic changes that you need for the budget. And I think the other thing is, I mean, you've got the continued impasse, it appears. I mean, cigarette tax, I mean, the general feeling at the Capitol seems to be that there's $1.50 in the House that could be passed, but only 75 cents in the Senate. So does that mean the wheels have come off and nothing happens? They just go away and that lays on the table and not part of the discussion? I think the gross production tax, clearly a great divide there on whether or not that's one of the areas that they're willing to put on the table and do something with and go from, you know, from where they are now to 7%, big lift. And I don't really see that as being a real viable option.
Ryan, do you think that if we don't get this, Governor Fallon has called for a lot of these to be passed, are we looking at a special session?
I think we have to. I mean, the crisis that is facing the state of Oklahoma, what's looming ahead of us in this next fiscal year if we don't close this budget gap, is catastrophic, nothing short of catastrophic. I mean, we've bemoaned, you know, 4-day school weeks. We've talked about some hospital bankruptcies, in particular in small towns, and the impact that these cuts have had on rural Oklahoma. But really what we're looking at has just been the tip of the iceberg. If you think about, you know, small towns that have one nursing home, and those nursing homes begin to close, and you have folks that are either, you know, where do they go? I mean, we can have this new population of homeless senior citizens in the state of Oklahoma. Our most vulnerable citizens are facing catastrophic consequences if we don't do something. So if the legislature can't get its act together and put together some sort of a responsible budget, I don't think that the governor has any choice but to call a special session.
And even last year, I think it was last year or the year before, she started vetoing bills until she started getting some kind of movement in the House and the Senate. So she does have a lot of power. Do you think she's going to start wielding some power next month?
There seems to be every indication that she's serious about doing that this year. And I think given where they are in the process, I think it's a very likely prospect for those lawmakers. And remembering that so many of these folks are so new to this process that they are really struggling, I think, in large measure to figure out who's really telling them the truth. I mean, where's the real rub in these numbers? And so I think without some real consensus on these big ticket items, it will fall to the governor probably to call them back into special session.
A coalition of 21 statewide organizations released their budget, an idea of what they would like to see to fix the shortfall and fully fund state government. Ryan, the Save Our State budget blueprint from education, mental health, and other groups call for raising revenue through various means, some of the ones that you were just talking about.
Yeah, well, and others, ending the capital gains tax break, stopping out-of-state tax shelters with combined corporate reporting, ending unnecessary sales tax exemptions for luxury purchases, you know, a 6% income tax rate on incomes between $200,000 and $400,000. So it would be a new higher rate that some of the higher earners in the state of Oklahoma would be paying. You know, and what we're looking at here is a responsible budget that puts us on a path to beginning to restore critical state services and avoid catastrophic events like we're on the verge of right now. And this is something that I think that deserves the attention of Republican and Democratic lawmakers. It used to be the case that whenever we talked about gross production tax, in particular oil and gas tax, you know, something that when we initiated the horizontal drilling tax credit, It didn't cost us a lot of money. It was this new novel thing. And now it's just the standard. And we have frozen in time that 2% rate that they're paying on these horizontal wells for the first part of the production. And it's costing the state hundreds of millions of dollars. Now we've got oil executives that are coming to the table saying, listen, we are sharing the pain in underfunded state services. We've got to do something better. What we've seen are a handful of oil execs and other folks that have said, no, listen, you know, we don't really care about the pain. We can shelter ourselves and shield ourselves from it. We send our kids to private schools. We live in gated community with private security. We do all of these things and not feel the hurt. But most Oklahomans are feeling the hurt. We got to do something different.
Neela.
Well, I think it was interesting. A couple of the points that they had in their blueprint, I mean, the one-time funding option where they looked at taking what would be $150 million when you take what's left in the rainy day, plus the additional $60 million that could be used if the emergency is declared. That component, I think the other part of the plan that was interesting is something else that's been out there talked about a lot on both sides, and that is the bonding of roads. I mean, Oklahoma roads and highways, their recommendation, I think, was $250 million. That clearly has had some traction, I mean, among Republicans as well as Democrats, and that is certainly something that I think should be at the table, because when you talk about core services, it's not all about just what these agencies need. It's about figuring out how to provide these services, and in some measure, some of them may legitimately be able to be privatized. And I think, you know, while sometimes that becomes a partisan issue, I think it's also a budget issue. I mean, if you can take services in some of these big agencies, such as DHS, and you can privatize, whether it's case management or other services where there are private providers already out there doing those similar services, many of those licensed professionals, and the savings can be in the tens, if not hundred millions of dollars, you have to look at those as areas where they need to have serious consideration, where before they've kind of gotten shuffled off to the side quickly because these agency directors have come over and been able to do their presentations and PowerPoints and confuse people enough to think that that's not an option.
And how much does this go back to every year we talk about modernizing our tax code, because we've got, and I was talking to Leslie Osborne, and she was talking about how our sales tax system goes back to the 1930s. Our income tax, we say that, you know, when we say the top rate of the income tax, well, that's $15,000 a year. So that's not really a top rate. That's just about everybody. And when we talk about the motor vehicle tax, which goes back to the 80s, these haven't been changed in decades.
Fuel tax, you know, 3 decades on a fuel tax. Yeah. This is, and we tied our hands back in the early 90s with regard to how we're going to reform a lot of this, because if we wanted to create a new income tax code that was progressive and fair to Oklahomans and raise the revenue that we need based on income tax, if we want to raise fuel tax, we end up in a situation where you've got to get these super majorities in the legislature or get a vote of the people. All of these things are incredibly difficult, if not impossible, given the current political climate. And so we can sit here and say we want to reform and modernize the tax code all day long, but the political effort that it requires to get that done just seems out of reach.
I think normally we would think it's out of reach, but I think it is. The prospects are brighter than I've seen in quite some time. I think when you look at Representative Osborne chairing A&B in the House, I think when you look at Senator Kim David, Senator A.J. Griffin, some of these folks that have really, really hunkered down and gotten in the trenches and really are working with these numbers and are very serious about looking past the first layer and seeing what let's just don't talk about modernizing, let's just don't, you know, use all of this political, you know, political rhetoric, and let's get down to putting some numbers on paper that might be workable, and then it gets down to how persuasive these folks can be to come up with the votes they need to get it done in both chambers.
And let's hope that Senator David and Representative Osborne are able to use the expertise that they have garnered over their time in the legislature to get something like that done before their term limits.
They seem very serious about it.
I believe that they are. I just worry that, you know, we've got the situation now where we talked earlier about how a lot of folks at the Capitol don't really understand the problem that we're in or who to trust.
They don't have much longer.
And then by the time they figure it out, it's like, oh, they've got to go. And so we're seeing that now with Senator David and Representative Osborne, both really coming into their own and understanding the appropriations process just at the time when they're about to leave the building because of term limits.
Yeah. A study released by the State Department of Education finds claims of cost savings from schools switching to 4-day weeks It doesn't appear to be to hold much water. The study was requested by Governor Fallon as the number of schools switching to four-day instructions is growing. Neva, do you think this could stop the flow of schools eliminating one days for education?
Well, I think the study certainly gives everyone pause. I mean, the governor asked for this analysis of the expenditures. They took 16 school districts. 9 of the 16 showed no savings. The others were marginal. So I think that dovetailing with what the state superintendent has said, and that is, let's look at the fact that we have to do what's best in terms of educating the kids. I mean, that has to be the top priority. So if the cost savings is not there, if it's just that we're gonna chop off another school day, and that's going to impact the learning process and instructional time in the classroom, then I think this is a legitimate concern, and I think the governor was correct in asking for this information to be quickly brought forward, and we'll just have to see. Clearly, it was something that school district seized on when you doubled the number in 1 year of those that went to the four-day week. I mean, it was something that whether they went to that notion thinking there was this tremendous savings. I mean, actually, when you look at some of those numbers, their administrative costs actually went up in these districts. They didn't go down. So it does bring it back to the home district, to the folks that, you know, the folks that need to pay attention locally and figure out what's going on with the dollars being spent in those districts.
Ryan.
Yeah, you know, that makes me wonder, and this may be in the study, but one of the questions that I had just looking at that, because you see those administrative costs going up, does that take into account inflation? Does it take into account rising healthcare costs? Other things that we're going to add, that we're going to create the discrepancy from this year's budget to last year's budget to begin with, and then if you take those out,
the increased number of students,
then were their savings or not? I don't. I mean, I think, you know, I'm all for continuing the questioning whether the traditional approach to education needs to be rethought. And, you know, if we're going to stay on a five-day school week just because that's what we've always done, and anybody that's alive can always remember that we've done, you know, that makes about as much sense as asking students to build an academic calendar around students staying home to help with the harvest.
Right, but I think it does make sense to require the districts to have a plan where they can actually outline what they intend to accomplish during that particular, whether it's four-day, five-day
right.
week. They've got to be able to justify that and make that mirror what is necessary to be able to give the kids the education they need to go on and be successful
in
life.
And I think that, you know, that's exactly right. We've got to, and so I'm for rethinking that, but if we're going to rethink that, it needs to be under the context and under the pretext that we're going to do this because it's going to improve educational outcomes for these students.
Absolutely.
And that doesn't really seem to be the criteria here. The criteria here seems to be, will this save us money? And that's unfortunate because, you know, we really need, if we're going to move to 4 day weeks, we need to ask the questions, does it improve education outcomes? And does, you know, what do we do for those students that on Friday that need their two meals at school and they're not going to get that now? I mean, there are these fundamental questions that have to be asked about 4 day work weeks or 4 day school weeks. I'm all for a 4 day work week, but a 4 day school week, you know, if we're going to ask these questions, it should be more than just about, you know, how does this make sense?
And the bottom line should be local control and accountability. I mean, if you say it's about the kids, then ultimately the local control and accountability of the dollars being spent in these individual school districts is where it really needs to rest.
And some schools are saying, well, we might not be saving any money, but we are saving our teachers. We are keeping our teachers in because we can go, look, if you're going to, you're not getting paid that much, but you're only having to work 4 days a week. And that's why it's become a domino. If you've got a teacher in, let's say, Coyle schools, it's my son's school goes 4 days a week and Guthrie's at 5 day. Well, if I'm a teacher at Guthrie, I might go, you know, I'll go work at Coyle. I'll get paid the same. I'll go over to Coyle. I only work 4 days a week. So they might not be saving money, but they might be saving their teachers.
Yeah, and I think that has to go into that calculation of, are you going to move to a 4 day school week? But again, this we should really be rethinking our educational model, not in terms of, boy, we've got a $900 million budget hole. The cuts that we're getting in our state appropriations each month keep going down and down and down, and we've got to do something. I mean, it would be nice if that's part of a teacher recruitment effort, if it's a part of an effort to make sure that students don't get burned out, if you've got some studies that demonstrate, whatever, let's talk about that. But that's not a substitute for a teacher pay raise. That's not a substitute for increasing benefits to students. I mean, that's, we're asking the wrong, we're asking questions here for the wrong reasons.
A new national poll puts Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon with an approval rating of just 41% and a disapproval rating of 52%. In fact, her approval rating puts her fifth worst in the country. Those with worse approval ratings include New Jersey's Chris Christie and Kansas's Sam Brownback. Nevo, what's going on here?
Well, I think what's going on is not a surprise. I mean, we have seen that the governor's poll numbers have continued to be on the decline, and the approval number going down. Part of that, I think, is voter fatigue and the fact that the governor's been in office now. I mean, getting to the final stretch of her two terms in office as governor, and then many years as lieutenant governor, congresswoman, state representative. So I think it is also, I would say, in some measure, when you look at these governors that are very unpopular, some of it is the climate in the state, where they're dealing with the budget difficulties, where they're dealing with political angst on the part of the lawmakers, as well as just frustration and disenchantment among the voters. And I think when you really start breaking that down and looking at it, unfortunately for the governor, I mean, she has seen probably from her time back in 2013, when her approval numbers were in the 70s, the low 70s, I mean, she's continuing to see this decline, but it's not uncommon. I mean, Brad Henry, as he reached the end of his term, had a dip and then actually came back up as he was leaving office in his approval number. So we'll just have to see. Success does moves the needle quickly. So if the governor is able to be successful in accomplishing some of her agenda, either at the end of this session or in her last session while in office, that may change those numbers dramatically.
Ryan.
Well, I think the voters in those states that where you do have governors that are have budget difficulties, the voters that have that are disapproving of the governors in those states recognize that the governors play a role in those budget difficulties. I mean, Sam Brownback right now, and the governor of Kansas, he's in a battle right now with moderate Republicans who want to expand Medicaid in the state. And I think that if we look at governors around us, Arkansas, they've got pretty high approval rating over there. They expanded Medicaid
and a relatively new governor, Asa Hutchins.
So, I mean, I think that we can look at this and say that Oklahomans are recognizing that the current failure in our state to pay for the services that we want, to have the revenue that we need, to be able to have the healthcare options that we expect, really comes back to executive decisions and leadership by the governor. And I'll agree with Neva here that this isn't the end. This isn't the last chapter of Governor Fallon's biography. She's got over a year left as governor, and another legislative session, possibly a special session. Mm-hmm. She can really step forward as a leader here. And I think that if you're going to do that, she has to recognize I'm term limited. I can be the grown up in the room. I can push for really big things, and lead. The legislature will only do so much, but if you've got a strong executive, and that's where I think that Governor Fallon, over her 8 years, whether you have agreed with her or disagreed with her, she has been not a real formidable force in the legislature. She has kind of let the legislature do their own deal. She has had her positions, but they haven't really ever either worked real good in tandem or come at loggerheads. And I think that, the governor last year did exercise some muscle when she started vetoing some bills. I think right now, if she stood up in the blue room at the state capitol and said, any bill that hits my desk that doesn't increase revenue and doesn't put us on the path to a responsible budget, I'm vetoing it. I don't care how good of an idea it is. We'll come back to it next year. Vetoing it.
It's interesting. The two most popular governors in that study, in those poll numbers, were in traditionally blue states. I mean, you look at Massachusetts. The governor there, Charlie Baker. I mean, he has a reputation for being a very shrewd bipartisan deal maker, someone who is really about results over party purity. Which is always the great, kind of the great rub oftentimes for governors. And, what he's seen in that state in Massachusetts is that the voters clearly have appreciated that style. I think style changes, and I think voter response changes over time. And it's very easy. Whoever's at the top is going to either be the beneficiary of the good times, or they're going to, unfortunately, get the knock in the bad times. And I think that's where the governor is right now, is like you say, Ryan. I mean, there are opportunities certainly still available for the governor in this session and next session to be able to utilize her office and be able to try and make some things happen.
If her disapproval rating gets much worse, is there concern from the party about people running to replace her in the next election.
Yeah, I think what in my view, the next election we will see very spirited multi-way primaries for both Republican and Democratic nominations statewide, from governor all the way down the secondary ticket. So I think that there'll be a reset. I think you'll have a lot of folks come out. There'll be a lot of different discussions. Now, will it be more tailored to specifics and less about just the generic, political rhetoric that both sides have typically tried to run on for quite some time at all levels of government? Or will it be with people? Do people want to see a plan? And I think that's a big question. We think they do, but do they really? I mean, they're not quite as tuned in as we want them to be sometimes or think they are. But the flip side of that is when times are really difficult and they start feeling it in their pocketbook, when they start seeing the impact in their local communities, they sometimes can be, have a very visceral response to that. And I think that's what we have to wait and see.
Well, and I think that if the next campaign are about generic political platitudes, then, I think the Republicans have a really strong advantage. If there is a real accounting for the last 8 years of the Fallon administration, the supermajorities that the Republicans have had in the legislature and where we currently are, if you live in a small town in Oklahoma and your hospital is closed, you don't have to look very far other than the decision by the Republican governor to not expand Medicaid, to look and say, why did that hospital close? Well, that's why it closed. I mean, if you have a nursing home that's closing, well, that's why it's closing. I mean, these are real consequences. And so if there's an accounting, I think that Republicans could be in trouble.
In general, maybe.
But when we talked earlier about the budget, and we said that there are these things that seem out of reach, real big tax reforms that seem out of reach. That's where I think the governor could get us if she wants to. If we want to close the budget gap or the budget hole by half and talk about increasing gross production to its historic rate of 7%, that's not going to happen unless the governor stands up and says, this has to happen. If we're going to increase taxes on higher income earners in Oklahoma, that won't happen with that leadership from Governor Fallon.
But the other option, which the governor has long talked about and the legislature has been resistant to, in terms of what they've really accomplished, and that is reducing the size of government in areas where they can make significant changes, however that comes about, whether it is duplication of services, whether it is privatizing services, whether it is, any combination of these things. There are hundreds of millions of dollars, I think, without question, that are there that could be looked at. And I think that's where a governor, if they really want to use the full force of their political, political chips, can get that done.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.